Religion like Buddhism offers us many different kinds of many different kinds of things. And it manifests itself in many different ways. It's very elusive and subtle thing that we call Buddhism has been spreading and manifesting itself right throughout much of the world for 2,500 years. For a lot of that time, Buddhism was probably the biggest religion in terms of numbers, the most influential in terms of being the kind of the major religion of some of the major civilizations. For much of the period of Buddhist history, for example, China has been the greatest civilization in the world, and Buddhism was the major, if not, or certainly one of the major, if not the major religion there. And of course we know that not just the current countries that are Buddhist, of course India was Buddhist for 1500 years. It was either majority Buddhist or at least a very large minority. As far east as Indonesia, as far west as modern day Iran, Iraq, these were all Buddhist lands. So in any kind of consideration of human history and what it means to be human, what is that story of what our growing up as humanity is, then Buddhism has a very large chapter, deserves a very large chapter in that book. And so there's something paradoxical about Buddhism or about the Dhamma. It's a very, we reflect on this and try to step back from it a little bit. There's something very strange about this. Very strange about the way that this religion, which, if we look at the essence of it, is very simple and can be summarized in just a few words. The Buddha was able to, so the genius of the Buddha was able to summarize his whole teaching in just a few words. My favorite summary of the teaching is just four words. Vaya dhamma sankhara apamadena sampadeta. Just four words in Pali. Vaya dhamma sankhara. Vaya dhamma means of the nature to fall apart, of the nature to decay. Sankhara means conditions, the conditioned things, the things we encounter in the world. So everything, conditions fall apart, things fall apart. Appamadena sampadeta, strive on with diligence. So these are, of course, the last words of the Buddha. Vaya dhamma sankhara appamadena sampadeta. And that summarizes very, very beautifully, very precisely the Buddha's teachings. Incredible precision with which he summarized his teachings in those four words. I remember when I first read the Mahaparinibbana Sutta about the Buddha's passing away, and then you kind of read that and read the Buddha's last words, you kind of think, oh, well, couldn't he have chosen something more original to say? I heard that before, it's a bit boring. But then the more you consider it, the more you realize how very precise that is. You know, there's these two halves of that saying, Vaya Dhamma Sankhara. This is a statement about the nature of the world, about the nature of our existence, about what our lives are. Yeah? Our lives are subject to, they're of the nature to change. And so this is a very important aspect of our lives which we tend to want to overlook or to deny. not that it's not, this is not the kind of the trivial assertion that things in fact change. Okay, so it's obvious that things change. Right? That's not, doesn't take a Buddha to point that out. What it takes a Buddha to point out is that it's the dhamma of things to change. It is the nature of things to change. So that change isn't considered as something which is kind of extrinsic to the objects, the things of the world, but it's their nature to change. And because of their conditioned nature. And so again, once the more we start going into this, we start to realize the profundity of it. The word sankhara also means like a condition, a cause of something. So it's the causal nature of things. The fact that things are produced through causes is what means that they are impermanent. They're impermanent because they're brought into existence because of causes and conditions. And when those causes and conditions are not there, then they also pass away. And so further and further we go into just these couple of words, we realize what the depth of insight there is in that. And then the second phrase the Buddha said, apamadena sampadeta, strive on with apamada diligence, they say, or with carefulness, with heedfulness. Many different ways of translating. It's difficult to exactly translate apamada. But again, not to marginalize or trivialize the importance and the profundity of that. The Buddha is saying that we can do something about this. We can do something about our human condition. We can do something about our lives. We don't need to slip into despair, nor do we need to rely on the act of a god or something like that in order to save us. But we can save ourselves. And this particular phrase has a very honourable history as a part of English literature. Apamadena sampadeta. There was a phrase in the King James Bible, which was something along the lines of to work out your salvation. And this was a translation, I can't remember the exact biblical passage, but the King James Bible, the first colloquial English translation of the Bible in about 1500s, and had this phrase, work out your salvation. And then the great ethnologist and anthropologist Sir James Fraser in about 1890 then first used that phrase, adopting it from the Bible, and used it in the context of Buddhism, and saying that Buddhism was about working out your salvation. And then from there it was adopted by Mr. Rice Davies, the great Pali, T.W. Rice Davies, the great Pali scholar and translator, translated the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, and that phrase he translated as work out your salvation with diligence. So it's made its way from the King James Bible to Sir James Fraser and now to T.W. Rice Davies, and then from there it was taken up by T.S. Eliot, who then quoted it in The Wasteland, work out your salvation with diligence. So this particular phrase has an extremely distinguished career in English literature. And that, of course, captures the part, yeah? And it has these two aspects, apamadena sampadeta, sampadeta, to strive or to put forth effort. But apamada like almost qualifies that striving by having an aspect of carefulness and balance. Like the root is from the root to be drunk. And it says not undrunkenness, yeah? Almost like undrunkenness. Or unmadness. A similar root is used for words to be mad. And so it has this idea of like discernment and care and intelligence in what one's doing. And so that the striving is not just simply, just doing lots of things for the sake of it. You know, it's not like a materialistic thing. So, these days, for example, we see a lot of Buddhists, they like to do maybe 100,000 prostrations or something like that. And you can see there's a vast difference in the quality with which people do that. So you have 100,000 prostrations, And if you go to Bodh Gaya, you can see all the Tibetan monks and nuns, and a lot of other people like to join in. They're all kind of up there and down there, working themselves into a sweat by doing all of these prostrations. And you can see some of them, it's just a matter of getting through the numbers. They're just ticking off one by one in their mind, and up and down, and they're sweating and they're getting down. And then other ones you can see are doing it with this incredible sense of care and grace and devotion as they're getting up and bowing down. And each time, they're really trying to make each one really special and really an aspect of letting go. And so that's the apamadena sampadeta. So you could say that all of them are doing the sampadeta. They're all striving, yeah? They're all trying to do what they think is the right thing. But some of them are doing with that quality, bringing the quality of their striving to it. And so this is that aspect. And of course, this is referring to the path. So the first phrase, vaya dhamma sankhara, referring to our situation. If we like, we can think of that as the first three noble truths, encompassing the first three noble truths, and then the last one encompassing the truth of the path. So the summary of the whole four noble truths. And so, if you like, Buddhism has this massive redundancy built into it. We can actually throw away everything else in all the Buddhism, all the other Buddhist scriptures. Think about it. All those whole big cabinets full of books in Pali and Chinese and Tibetan and Sanskrit and everything like that. We can throw them all away. We can burn them all. All the libraries full of Buddhist books. All the websites on Buddhism. And if we just keep those four words, vaya dhamma sankhara apamadena sampadeta, and we'd still have the key to Buddhism. That's it. Everything else is just repetition or elaboration or redundancy. So of course, I don't really mean that really literally, okay? I'm kind of playing around here, so don't take me too seriously. I'm not advocating burning all the Buddhist books or anything like that. Don't take me too seriously. I'm just pointing to this fact of how distilled we can put that. So Buddhism, we could say, really is just those four words. Understanding those four words is really what Buddhism is about. Or we could say Buddhism is this whole thing, this whole vast cultural, social, economic phenomenon, human phenomenon, which has spanned half of the globe for 2,500 years and has influenced the lives of billions of people. So, you know, it's quite appropriate for us to ask questions like, well, okay, the Buddha came and taught all these wonderful things. Was he successful? That did Buddhism work, in a sense? Is the world, after this incredible effort, think about it, an incredible effort to be Buddhist and to promote Buddhism and to build all of these temples and do all of these things all across the world for all of this time, and has that made the world a better place? What would the world be like if it wasn't for Buddhism? Would something else have happened that would have been just as good? Yeah? What difference has it made? Sometimes it seems that the world's a worse place. We feel like the world's much more violent now than it was 2,500 years ago. Is that right? Murder. People commit murder much more often now than they did hundreds of years ago. Is that right or no? Denise shaking her head. A lot of battles. Maybe not. But often we think that things are getting worse, don't we? Anyone else have any opinions? Are things getting... Is humanity getting more or less violent?
It's a lot more of it to get violent.
There's more to get violent.
It's more of it.
Yeah. And it's harder to avoid each other now, yeah? In the old days, we could just kind of disappear and not have anything to do, but these days it's a bit harder. But it's just the reason I asked that question. There's been a study done recently, and a fellow's just putting forth an argument, a very strong argument, that in fact humanity has become much less violent, and dramatically so, and that this has been, that you can observe this on different levels. It's like a fractal phenomenon, which has the same kind of shape. It's a curve that has the same shape no matter what degree of resolution that you use. So if you look over the millennia, then you'll still see the same thing. And so when they look over the millennia, they judge it by, say, the amount that they look at sort of cavemen skeletons and how many of them have got their skulls bashed in with stone axes. Yeah, and there's a lot of them. Yeah, a lot of cavemen met very nasty ends. And then, so that's on a big scale, and then they look at it on a century scale, where you can look at things a bit more precisely. And on the scale of centuries, a very interesting statistic, for example, in England, I think it was in the 1400s, if I'm not wrong, the homicide rate was 24 per 100,000. And in the 1960s, it was 0.6 per 100,000. Yeah? So the homicide rate had fallen from 24 per 100,000 to 0.6 per 100,000. Yeah? Which is quite a remarkable difference, yeah? And so it's never, you know, we can never know these things for sure. We can never judge them 100%. But perhaps it's the case that our perception, we get these perceptions fed through the media and so on of war and all of these kinds of things, but perhaps it's the case that humanity is actually learning some of its lessons. It's amazing, isn't it? Maybe Buddhism, and I'm sure many other religions as well, but here we're just thinking about Buddhism. Maybe Buddhism has actually had some success and some role in that, in promoting ideals like non-violence and harmony and the value of dialogue and cooperation and all of these kinds of things. One of the things we notice about if we look at that big picture, human civilization, human history, we have this period that we call the Axial Age, which was like approximately 500 BC. And it was around that period that most of the great religions were actually founded or established or reformed or something. We have Confucius and Lao Tzu in China, and in India, the Buddha, Mahavira, the great leader of the Jain religion, and also some of the great Hindu sages like Yajnavalkya and others, about the age of the Upanishads. In the further west, you had the founding of the Zoroastrian religion, and the formulation of the Old Testament was kind of formed around that time. And in particular, the ethical dimension of the Old Testament was really introduced and formalized around that period. And then, of course, in Greece, you have the age of the great Greek philosophers, who all lived within a couple of generations of each other. Pythagoras, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, they all lived within a few generations of each other. And more or less all over the world, these people coming up with these ideas. And there's some certain similarities in this, that whole spectrum, certain similarities. Almost like people were coming to the similar kinds of conclusions. Of course, in different ways. Not to say that these things are all exactly the same. They're not at all. But some aspects of them are very similar. And one of those aspects was that our religious or our spiritual life should be based on an ethic of compassion. And this idea of realizing that we are all human, and that as fellow humans that we need to, that we each feel pain, and that pain we need to listen to, that to understand that, and that it's wrong for us to treat people in a way that disrespects that, or in a way that causes pain and harm and so on. And so these kinds of ideas were introduced around that period, and nobody thought of anything better. We keep on working out the details of these Axial Age philosophies and getting more refined and so on and so forth. But nobody's actually come up with any insights, any deep level insights or ways of looking with things, looking at the world, which is any better than that, or which disproves it or says that there's anything wrong with it. No one's ever been able to fault these aspects of things. Of course, when we look at these teachings, of course, we can always find details we might fault. For example, if you look in the Buddhist scriptures, they talk about a Mount Meru, this great mountain which is 84,000 yojanas high. A yojana is about 15 kilometres. So 84,000 yojanas, it's about 1,000,000 miles high or something like that. So it goes about to the moon or something like that. If we were going to take that literally, it would be a mountain that goes halfway to the moon or something like that. So, well, obviously there isn't any mountain which is that big. And so we can't take the Buddha scriptures too literally in that respect. And so there are some things like that which we can modify according to the, you know, we get a greater knowledge of science and so on. But in terms of the ethical teachings, the spiritual teachings, nobody has gone beyond these things. Nobody has come to a deeper insight or a deeper understanding of who we are, what our place in the world is, and what we can do about it. Perhaps nobody ever will. Perhaps it is the case that the wisdom that the Buddha realized underneath the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya is actually the deepest wisdom which is possible. Perhaps this is the case. So, given that we're dealing with such a vast and complex thing as Buddhism, this incredible cultural, spiritual, sociological phenomenon that has all these dimensions, then, in a sense, we it becomes one of these things. We can't do all of it. We can't learn everything about Buddhism. We can't study everything. We can't practice every practice. We can't do everything, right? And so we have to pick and choose. We have to look in that whole sphere, that whole realm, and say, what does it mean for me? Like, what is the most important thing? What do I want to take on board? And we can actually take on, you know, many different things we can find in Buddhism. I'll give you an example. There's an inscription from ancient India, about 1200 years old, and this inscription has a Buddhist text. And underneath, there is, at the bottom of the Buddhist text, there is the inscription. It says at the bottom, if anybody destroys or damages or defaces this inscription, may in the future life their mother be a pig and their father be a donkey. Alright? Not only does it have that, it actually illustrates it as well. Okay, so it's an illustrated version of a pig having sex with a donkey, okay, with this curse saying, may your mother be a... And this is at the bottom of a Buddhist text. Now, is this what we want to take out of Buddhism? Right? Do we want to pick this up and say, oh yes, this is the teaching which I find so inspiring and uplifting and... Well, perhaps not. Perhaps we might agree that this isn't, you know, the most important thing in Buddhism. And so we begin to look around and we say, well, what actually is very important? And it's, of course, it's not long before we come into differences and where, you know, people are emphasizing different things and we can have differences of opinion. We can disagree about things. And, you know, there are many areas of disagreement, you know. There are many, for example, many Buddhists in Mahayana Buddhists who for them the most important and meaningful scriptures are, say, something like the Heart Sutra. And people come from a Theravadan background like myself or who come from a historical background will say, well, the Heart Sutra wasn't actually spoken by the Buddha. It was composed 700 or 800 years after the Buddha. And so that's a very fundamental difference in perspective on that particular scripture. Some people saying it's the essence of everything the Buddha said, and other people saying, well, the Buddha didn't say it at all. That's a fairly radical divergence of opinion. Yeah? You can't get that much further apart. So, what kind of criteria do we use to negotiate our way through this kind of minefield? Often the criteria we use is not very reflective. Or maybe it's very accidental. Maybe it just happens to be that you were walking through Chatswood and you saw the advertisement for the talk tonight, and so you happened to come along here. And maybe it's chance, if there was such a thing as chance. Yeah, I don't know. But so maybe it's something like that. Often it is like that, isn't it? It's just, you know, my own encounter with Buddhism was very much like that when I went to Thailand, staying in Chiang Mai, and oh, there happened to be a monastery nearby where they were teaching meditation in English, so I went along there and learnt that. That's all. I had nothing more reflective or considered about it than simply to plunge in and see where it took me. So there are many different ways of trying to understand this, trying to understand what is Buddhism, what do we really need to do, what do we really need to practice. And of course, one of the most beautiful teachings was the teaching that the Buddha gave to his foster mother Mahapajapati when she came to see him. And he said, I can't remember the exact phrases now, but he said, look, whatever is leading to contentment and is not leading to having many wishes, whatever is leading to letting go and not leading to holding on to things, whatever is leading to simplicity is not leading to complexity, and whatever is leading to giving up and renunciation and is not leading to getting and gratification, then those things you should regard it for certain. This is the Dhamma, this is the Vinaya, this is the teaching of the Buddha. So this is giving a very beautiful standard or guideline for us to practice, that always need to keep this in mind. Whatever we're doing, whatever we're thinking, whatever we're saying, always to be thinking this. Is this actually leading to those qualities that the Buddha spoke of? Is this leading to letting go? Do I understand what letting go is in this context? And it's very easy to get confused about these things. One story that Ajahn Seung used to tell when he was in his little book called Awareness Itself, and he was a Thai master, and he said one woman came to him and told him she was confused, she didn't know what to do. And she said, because she had a little stall, she would sell food at the little stall in Bangkok, and the fellow would come along and say, you know, you should give away your food for free, you're a Buddhist, what are you doing charging money for it? Yeah, that's just, you're just grasping, you're just attached to having the money from your food. And so she came to Ajahn Seung and said, I don't know what to say to him. I know that I'm charging a fair price and I have to live. So what do I do? And Ajahn Seung said, next time he comes along, you just tell him, I didn't become a Buddhist in order to be stupid. That's right, isn't it? We didn't become a Buddhist in order to be stupid. So the Buddha never asked us to check in our brains at the gate of the temple, okay? We're allowed to bring our brains in, we're allowed to use them, we're allowed to be critical. Yeah, we're allowed to look and judge and say, okay, is this right, is this wrong, and use our powers of discernment to evaluate, to understand what's the right thing to do. So there are some things which in our spiritual life which I think we should, which are very good guidelines or help us if we want to know what's actually right, what's Dhamma and what isn't Dhamma. You know, when we see, you know, spiritual teachers, spiritual teachings and so on involved with money, then forget it. Power, right? Especially like power trips, like guru trips, where a teacher is sort of, you know, getting power over students and manipulating them and controlling and all of this kind of thing, then just forget that, throw it out. Drugs, sex, yeah, politics, all of these kinds of things, these are all kind of worldly dhammas, yeah? These are the things that we're doing, we're kind of involved in worldly dhammas. So when we come to the spiritual life, then we should be coming into a safe zone, like a simple zone, a clear zone, where these things are, where we don't have to worry about these things. We can leave these things behind and come into a place where we're trying to lift ourselves up. And so if we see a spiritual teacher or teaching who is, you know, mixing up these things, you know, like a teacher who's sleeping with their students, or, you know, who's trying to, you know, always trying to, you know, get money out of people, or all of these kinds of things, then we should know, actually, this is not dhamma. Yeah? Don't be fooled by these things. Sometimes these things can come in many different guises. There can be people who maybe are very well-known, powerful, charismatic teachers. Yeah? Charisma is not a guide to what is dhamma and what is not. Okay? Charisma is not a guide. People can be very charismatic and very, very twisted. Okay? And this is something we meet again and again and again. And sometimes it's almost as if the more charisma you have, the more dangerous it is, both for the person who has the charisma, because their mind can start to believe their own projections. Yeah, and even they maybe start out with pure intentions, but it doesn't take long for those to get corrupted. So please don't regard this. This is not your criteria, like how popular is a teacher, how charismatic are they, and all of these kinds of things. These things are very, very dangerous. Please stay away from them. And really look to that essence of what is that dhamma. Remember that one of the characteristics of a stream enterer in Buddhism is the first stage of awakening. And one of the characteristics of the stream enterer is said to be aparapachaya. It means not dependent on another. Yeah? So somebody who's a real teacher of dhamma is somebody who's trying to develop people who are aparapachaya, who are not dependent. They're not dependent on a teacher, not dependent on a guru. So these things are never part of the way of dhamma. And so I guess kind of the purpose of this talk, to try to encourage you to use your discernment when listening to dhamma, when listening to different teachers, to be able to understand what is dhamma and what is not dhamma. One of the great, if not the greatest, I guess two great tools in this, which are unsurpassed tools in being able to do this. One is reading the suttas and having a good knowledge of the Buddhist discourses. And so then we can very simply say, is this, you know, in line with what the Buddha was teaching in the suttas, is very important. And the second thing, of course, is our own meditation practice. And so through our meditation practice, to learn that skill of being able to look very honestly and sincerely within our own heart, to be able to answer to the qualities we find there, to be honest, to be completely honest with ourselves about what we're actually seeing within our own heart. Through doing that, we will know. We will have that intuitive knowledge to be able to know, is this dhamma or is this not dhamma? We can ask and know. So these two things, I think, are extremely important for us to be able to make these kinds of discernments. You know, there are a lot of people who get involved in spiritual circles who get damaged. And I just heard, for example, of one retreat. And when I had a doctor on the retreat, and the doctor diagnosed 10% of the people with clinical depression as a result of doing the retreat. That wasn't they were depressed before they came, they were depressed after they were there, because the retreat was so goal-oriented, telling people to get this and attain that, and they didn't get anything and they didn't attain anything, and so they just got depressed instead. Yeah, I'm sure we've all felt that to one degree or another, but this was actually diagnosed by a doctor as being clinically depressed. Okay, so that's not just an occasional feeling of disappointment or something, that's quite serious. So these are things which we need to be very careful with. Yeah? Need to be very careful with. Don't be too quick to believe anything anyone says. Certainly don't be too quick to believe anything I say. And including that last statement. If you can work that one out. And try to find for yourself, there's that moment of truth. There's that moment of truth which happens to you when you are in meditation, when you've just had a very peaceful meditation, when you find that sense of contentment and truth and fulfillment within yourself. There's that moment, yeah? We can't necessarily experience that moment every time we sit meditation, okay? But sometimes we might experience that and we go there, we go to that place, oh. That's the truth, that's the Dhamma there. So try to remember that. These moments, they make an impression on our mind, they make an impression on our consciousness. Try to remember that. That's like a seed, that's like something you can use, you can remind yourself. That's the Dhamma, I know that. Give yourself the confidence of that, yeah? Maybe you can't experience it all the time, but that, as far as I've gone along the path, I can understand and I can trust the Dhamma, because when I practiced according with the Dhamma, I found this moment. I found this place of peace and truth within myself. And we trust that, yeah? And we use that as a standard. And then we'll be able to, that will help us to be able to understand and appreciate what is Dhamma. So this is my little talk for you this evening on Dhamma, on the big Dhammas and the little Dhammas, and on trying to discern our way through the minefield of Dhammas. So I offer this to you for your reflection this evening. I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.